Mary, I'm here.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Human Rights Demand. Human Rights Demand is the radio channel where we make a demand for human rights for all people. The interesting thing is that demand that was made years ago by one Frederick Douglass. He said that power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will. And we want to thank you right now for caring enough about human rights that you join us here each week on Thursdays to discuss human rights for homeless people. Human rights for homeless people, especially the homeless mentally ill. This is the Bob Darby Advocate for Homeless Mentally Ill show. Bob Darby has been a strong advocate for the homeless mentally ill for over 20 years. Moreover, Mr. Darby is an excellent human rights advocate for many different causes. He co-founded Food Not Bombs in Atlanta, Georgia. He's a graduate of, I think it's Mercer University, isn't it, Bob?
No, Emory University.
Emory University, where he got his undergraduate degree in psychology. He went on to pursue a master's in psychology and theology. I think it was theology.
Well, actually,
he's worked at numerous hospitals and working with people who have mental health conditions for a number of years. And he's right here with us right now. I'm going to turn it over to him because he can tell you about his background better than I can. I don't have my notes in front of me. I just know him as Bob, who cares about people. He doesn't care whether it's black people, white people, Native Americans, Asians. Bob Darby cares about people. And the thing is that he cares about the so-called least among us. You know, those are people who have, you do nice things for some people, and you expect a return on that in some way, someday. Many people buy their bosses a nice gift on Boss's Day. Many bosses buy their secretaries and their staff nice gifts. But the thing is, you expect a return on that. You know that they will buy you something back someday, and you also expect work productivity to be good because you're a caring boss. You know, many of the things we give away, we expect a return on that, even if we give it as a gift. But here is a man who gives of himself to people who he has no hope of being paid back from them. He has no hope of them paying him back. And that doesn't matter to him one bit. It does not stop him from wanting to care about them and to speak truth to power about them. I tell you, this man is awesome. His name is Bob Darby. He lives right here in Atlanta, Georgia. And he's been standing up for people who cannot stand up for themselves for over 20 years. Bob Darby, welcome to Human Rights Demand.
Well, thank you, Mary, for all of those good things you said about me. I'm far from perfect, and I would like to do a lot more than I actually am doing because I cannot be silent when I go out and just take a walk in my own neighborhood and see people who are clearly homeless, who are clearly without hope, who are hungry, who don't have medical care, who are living in constant fear of being arrested for simply being, for being arrested for vagrancy, or if they have nowhere to relieve themselves, for going to urinate behind a bush or in an alley, or whatever they have to do to survive, everything, or finding a place to sleep at night. Anywhere they go, they have to try to hide because We have 3,000 police officers in Atlanta, Georgia. 40% of the people incarcerated are mentally ill. 40%. And a great percentage, I don't know what that is, a great percentage of the homeless problem, certainly, I would say certainly more than 40%, great percentage of the people in jail and prison are there because they are homeless, because they have absolutely nowhere to go, and the police picked them up. And the primary care provider these days for mental illness is the incarceration system, is jails and prison. So I'm not such a saint. I'm merely one person among many who's trying to sound an alarm about the terrible thing that's happening in America, which is that we are turning into, if we have not already arguably turned into, a police state, a state in which if you are not out there trying to live entirely to accumulate money and power, then you're deteriorating and you're going the opposite direction and you're going towards jail and destruction. So this is a society that's going in the wrong direction, and I am one person among many, not a saint, certainly I appreciate the good things you said about me, but I'm alarmed and I'm frightened with what I see going on, and I feel like I have to speak out. What's going on is... It is becoming a crime to be homeless. It is a crime to be homeless. It's a crime to be mentally ill. It's a crime to be poor and to have addiction problems with alcohol or other drugs. And if there were ever a society in the history of the world that truly worshipped mammon, then it's this one. Mammon is an Aramaic or Hebrew term for the ancient worship of material goods and wealth, or in excess of material goods. So if you look up mammon in the dictionary, M-A-M-M-O-N, what it means is wealth. So when Jesus said, you cannot serve God and mammon, what he meant is that you cannot live a virtuous life and pursue wealth for its own sake at the exclusion of the interest of other people. So that's what the kind of society we're building up right now. I wanted to say that last week there was a 60 Minutes program, and I normally like 60 Minutes. I normally feel like I have a lot of respect for it. It's a CBS program that's been on for, I think, over 40 years on Sunday nights at 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, if you're not familiar with it. It's a documentary program. Normally I like it, but they had a program that was on in praise of billionaires who have pledged a significant portion of their great fortunes to charity, although the charities weren't always specified exactly what they were. But if you have $60 billion, like Bill Gates has, if you pledge $30 billion of that to a variety of charities, well, it's good that those charities are getting that money. But you still have $30 billion left over. That's $30,000 million. That is an almost impossibly inconceivable amount of money for one person to possess. In fact, $1 million, which is $1 billion, is a huge amount of money. It's more than any one person could possibly want to have for themselves. But that's not enough. This country is controlled by a handful of billionaires, 200 people, according to Robert Reich, the former Secretary of Labor under President Clinton, says 200, less than 200 actually, I think it's 180 people, individuals, control more than half of the entire wealth of the United States, of the entire gross domestic product of the United States, is controlled by 180, not 180,000, but 180 people control more than half of the entire wealth of the United States. So this phenomenon is increasing. There are more and more billionaires, and there are more and more, vastly more and more poor people being created all the time. more and more people being thrown out on the streets, more and more people being put in jail. The United States is far ahead from any other ahead of any other country in the entire world in its per capita incarceration rate. You know, look around you. If you do not have money, if you are having a hard time, we're living in smells blood, and you're liable to be picked up for some reason. If you can't afford a lawyer and you have to depend on the public defender, you are almost certainly going to have your life ruined by jail, by losing your work, losing your job, and you will be effectually destroyed. That doesn't mean that we live in a completely totalitarian state yet. We can still speak out. We can still organize, but the trend is now away from just being a plutocracy, which is a society ruled by wealth, to being a plutocratic totalitarian state, which is a state in which it is a crime to speak out against the horrendous conditions in which we're living. The conditions in which we're living are horrendous for millions of people in the United States already, and they're becoming horrendous for millions and millions more. But if we don't speak out, if the ordinary rank and file of Americans don't start speaking out and protesting and trying to stop the incline that this country is on towards plutocratic, which means the worship of wealth, the worship of mammon, totalitarianism, which then we are going to find ourselves, we're going to wake up one morning and find ourselves living in a nightmare such as the world has never seen before. That's what I'm motivated to do, is to speak out against this and to try to give some kind of hope, to try to get some kind of help, even if it's just for a very few individuals at a time, by saying that America is on the wrong track, the world is on the wrong track, and something needs to be done about it. We have at least 3 million people in jail and prisons. We have 1% of the entire population of the United States. That includes children. The entire population of about 300 million people are in prison or jail. That's a lot. And that means that, considering the fact that about half the population is juvenile, is under 18, that means that about 2% of the population, 1 out of 50 people, is incarcerated. One out of 50 of all adults is in jail or prison in this country. That doesn't count the numbers of people who are in the system or on probation or on parole. We are living now in a police state that is rapidly becoming a totalitarian police state because the NSA, National Security Association or Authority, and the CIA and these super secret organizations are keeping track of us and are acquiring more and more technological abilities to keep track of each and every one of us and what we do. And if they get the chance, they're going to fix it so that we're going to wake up one morning and we really don't have any rights at all. The whole country will be here. The whole world will be here for the benefit of a tiny, very, very tiny percentage of the population who are the super rich. That is what my message is. And I appreciate being appreciated, but I don't expect to get a lot of rewards for this because a lot of rewards are not forthcoming towards people who are trying to tell the truth. And if I can congratulate myself or anything, I'm trying to understand what is going on. And the first thing that I notice when I'm trying to understand that is the ever-increasing numbers of people who are living on the streets, who are thrown into prison and jail, who are hungry, who have no medical care, all of these things. So I live here in the United States. We need to take care of our own first. We need to clean up our own act. We're only 5% of the world's population. We have the highest per capita in prison incarceration rate in the world. We spend as much as the rest of the world combined on military things. We're 5% of the world's population. We spend more than 95% of the world on weapons. So we are becoming the world's arsenal. We have become the world's arsenal for the super rich, for those who worship at the altar, so to speak, of mammon, which is extravagant wealth. So that's my message, and I'll turn it over to Mary. I hope that people feel free, people who are listening to this, will call into the radio station at 347-857-3293 at the Human Rights Demand, Blog Talk Radio, and join in our conversation and tell us your story and tell us your perspective on what's going on in this country. If we're not looking for people to agree with everything we say. If you have a disagreement, please air it, because I can make mistakes and Mary can make mistakes. We can say things that are controversial, and sometimes we may not be entirely correct. So please call 347-857-3293 and help educate us on what you see going on. And I'll turn this over to Mary now and see what Mary has to say in this conversation.
Well, thank you, Bob Darby. Thank you very much for telling us. You know, that's what I like to do, what you just did. You went to the root of the problem. And, of course, what you found there at the root of the problem is what God said you found there, and that is mammon, that is money, the love of money. You know, money is a wonderful thing to have. It's a good thing to have. The Bible says the love of money is the root of all evil, not money itself. You know, God blessed a number of people that he admired and respected and loved with lots of money. The trouble is not having lots of money when the money owns you. It's when the money owns you, when it defines who you are, and it defines you as being someone who's apart from other people, and you don't care about other people. You don't try to use your finances to help other people, and you think that you should be treated royally simply because you have money. That's when money has you, rather than you having money. And the thing is that money is a wonderful thing. We all, especially advocacy organizations, we need money. We need money because we need to reach out and be able to assist more people. You know, what do you need your money for? You know, the thing is, what do you do with the money that you have? And Bob mentioned Bill Gates to you. Now, the truth is that Bill and Melinda Gates, his wife Melinda, they have a foundation called the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And this foundation, as I understood it, invested heavily in the private prison system. So, yes, he gave away a few dollars, but he kept a whole lot, as Bob Darby pointed out. And his foundation is investing in human suffering. That's the private prison system. So that's what we have in some of our do-gooders. If you look beneath the surface, they're not really what they project themselves to be. Some people have to get rid of money just simply to fall into the comfortable tax bracket, because maybe they have to give away money simply to keep themselves in that tax bracket. And so that's good. You know, the thing is, when you give away money, that's a wonderful thing. But wow, isn't it something? Doesn't it blow your mind to know that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is investing in prisons? They're investing in human suffering. They're investing in the system that holds 1.25 million mentally ill people in jail that actually goes into people's houses and basically kidnaps their weakest members. And they're investing in that system. And, you know, it's a gloomy day in Georgia. It's kind of rainy. You know, it's really kind of a – I usually like the rain, okay? I usually like rainy weather and storm weather, especially when it's been hot like it has. But today is just such a heavy day emotionally that I just wish the sun was shining and the birds were singing, because today is very heavy emotionally. In a little while, we're going to bring on Ms. Lynn Eaglefeather, and she's going to tell you about the murders that happened over the weekend, I believe, in New Mexico. Teenage boys murdered homeless people while they slept. And they murdered homeless people who were already sleeping outdoors from the lack of shelter. And they took cinder blocks, metal pipes, fence pipes that you use for fencing, and bricks. And they bashed those people's heads in. They beat them to death. They attacked them while they were asleep. I'm not going to take her story. I'm going to just let you know that that happened. You see, that's the kind of violence that sometimes happens to people who are living outdoors. And that's what's going on in America. While you and I may have had a nice weekend, you know, we may have barbecued. Some people went to the beach. Some people went to parties. Some people went to church. Whatever you did this weekend, I want you to reflect on how these mentally ill people, they may have been, but in any case, they were homeless people, how they spent their weekend or the last moments of their lives this weekend while they were being brutally attacked by wild teenagers. These things happen when you're living outdoors, and I want you to hear it from Ms. Lynn, but I just want to ask Mr. Bob Darby, did he hear about many cases of street violence, not just violence by the police? We're well familiar with the police and their abuse of the mentally ill, homeless. But I want to ask you, how much street violence do you see or your clients tell you about when you were feeding the hungry, Bob?
Well, there's a good bit of street violence. In fact, one story with which I'm familiar about homeless and mentally ill people being victimized by very often other street people, and who knows who did it. But I used to work with a group called the Mad Housers, which built small, very small huts for the homeless in the woods. And they at one point had 100 different huts going in little one-person prefabricated, well-designed living quarters for single individuals who were homeless in the woods in secluded places. Well, one time fairly recently, I don't know, I can't say exactly when because my memory doesn't allow that. One person's hut was set on fire while he was in it, and this person, as I understand it, was mentally ill, but was, like most mentally ill persons, not dangerous, but not a highly functional person. But one person's hut was set on fire from the outside. That was what the fire department determined, and he was burned to death. And while in the inside the hut, people who are homeless, sometimes when they sleep, like you said, sometimes they sleep, people will attack them. Sometimes police will attack them and say that they, you know, charge them with assault if they survive the attack, charge the homeless people with assault themselves for defending themselves, or just charge them with assault, period, when in fact the assault was conducted by the police or by other people. So it's an all-out war against the homeless, and most particularly the most helpless among the homeless, who are the mentally ill, and I should add also the addicted, which is a population that overlaps that of the mentally ill. Many of the people who are mentally ill are also addicted to alcohol and or drugs. So being homeless is an extremely dangerous, you know, condition to be in. It's dangerous because of the possibility of assault from, frankly, some other homeless people. It's dangerous because the possibility of assault from people who are not homeless, who just are hoodlums. It's a dangerous from assault from the police. So people are murdered who are homeless. It's not uncommon, and we don't hear much about it because it's generally not covered very, very extensively in the press. But you hear about it if you work with homeless people. You hear about it if you are operating a program like this, like Blog Talk Radio. People will call in, like Miss Eagle Feather, and tell stories that she knows are certainly true about how people she knew, maybe members of her family, who were murdered by the police and who were murdered and nothing was done about it because they have no rights and they have been devalued as human beings because they're homeless. So no doubt this is the situation we're living in. When you become homeless, you lose your citizenship rights. You lose more than your citizenship rights. You lose, in the eyes of many people, your rights as a human being, and you, and anything, you're completely vulnerable to attack from, including the people who are supposed to protect you. Anyway, that's what I would like to say about your inviting me to comment on this situation, Mary. What do you have to say now, Mary? Do you have a comment? Mary, are you there?
I am here, Bob. Yes, I'm here with you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, Bob.
Sometimes I mute my phone so that background noises that's going on will not
Mary, I can barely hear you.
Sometimes I mute. Okay, I was saying that sometimes I mute my phone while you're talking. So that the background noises will not disturb you. But I did hear you, and I am glad that you answered that question so that we can let the people know how they really are the homeless at greater risk for pneumonia and other diseases because they're eating out of trash oftentimes. Somebody, you know, they might ask someone for some money, and I've seen people just hand them the rest of their hamburger or what have you. That's a good way to get TB or herpes or whatever germs are on that sandwich. These things happen. So not only are they at greater risk for disease and pneumonia and those type of diseases from being out in the elements, but they are often, not just occasionally, but often brutally attacked and assaulted. As Bob said, sometimes by other homeless people, sometimes by people like police officers, official people. It's a horrible existence. I remember one show we had that we listened to Miss Lynn Eaglefeather, and she said that she used to sleep under a bridge with her back against the wall so she could be pointed out toward anybody who might approach her. And so these people have to, when they do find a place that they have to sleep with really both eyes open and stay forever alert for predators. You know, we all enjoy looking at National Geographic. And now and then, National Geographic gets quite gruesome because whatever little animals we watched grow up in the forest. You know, they may take us through a life cycle. Whatever little animals we've been watching grow up through the forest, the day will come when they will be faced by a predator. And so this happens to homeless people. They are accosted by predators. I wrote an article a few years ago about this homeless man. He happened to be a Caucasian man. He had been to the military. He was a veteran. He used to sit, tickle plates, on the outside of an alley. So it was more or less on the corner of an alley and a sidewalk. And that was where he'd sit all day. And he had a family, he had sisters. You know, you got to understand that homeless people are all connected to somebody. They've got family, and their families may really love them. But when a person has schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, PTSD, or a bad alcohol problem, which most of the homeless usually have one of those, the family oftentimes cannot deal with that. And sometimes they can't deal with their family because of other reasons. Sometimes family members live in subsidized housing, and they're not allowed to take in anyone. You see, that's how cruel the government is. It when welfare first came out, men and women, married people, couldn't stay together. I admit if somebody's on welfare. So homeless people, though, do have family. This man happened to have sisters that I saw on newspaper stories crying over him when he was killed. Know who did it.
Hello, Mary. Hello, Bob.
Hello.
Hello, Mary.
No, this is Lynn.
Hi, I'm calling in to speak on the air. I think you lost your air signal.
Bob, thank you
yeah.
so much for taking over. That was a stalker. They cut me off. I want to apologize to the radio audience. We're here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm not sure it would matter where we were because I'm the most censored person in America. You are listening to the voice of America's most censored individual. And that is because my name is Mary Neal, N-E-A-L. I'm an advocate for the incarcerated mentally ill, which is the most preyed upon group in this world because they are all targeted for incarceration. And also I'm treated that way when I try to go on the radio because they murdered my brother. My brother, Larry Neal, was secretly arrested one day. Not a prisoner. He was not an inmate. He was secretly arrested. And they kept him 18 days in Memphis Shelby County Jail while lying and saying that the police did not have him in custody. That was a complete lie. He was in custody. And on the 8th day of secret incarceration, they murdered him. And they will not give us the information on how they murdered Larry Neal, in spite of the fact that that jail, the Memphis Shelby County Jail, was already under overview by the United States Department of Justice. So this is a murder cover-up that involves the United States Department of Justice, It involves Memphis Shelby County, Tennessee jail. It involves my family. That was my brother. So every time I'm on the radio, important people start sweating. Every time I'm on the radio or whenever I go online, period, I have 4 stalkers who sat with me. I'm going to show you the film one day when I sign on at Facebook, how someone else signs on right there with me. You can see them typing in the number, signing on with me. And these things happen. I'm censored to prevent more people from knowing that mentally ill people are not only arrested for, as they say, cutting up, but they're arrested simply because police do it. And I'm not really sure what they did to my brother, why they wanted to murder him. But they did murder him. They secretly arrested him and kept him 18 days, and they murdered him some way that they won't even tell us. This is the coming up to the 11th anniversary of that murder, and they will not release any information. One time when I sent a Freedom of Information Act request to the United States Department of Justice for a release of information about Larry Neal's secret arrest and his murder, they sent me back a letter saying that they would not answer me because it would be against national security interests. Now, how is it that a police murder in Memphis has anything at all to do with national security? I think that my brother was waterboarded. That's what I think. I have no one ever told me that or anything, but I do know that in 1994, a man named Stampley, S-T-A-M-P-L-E-Y, I believe it was murdered that way in Missouri or Minnesota. He was murdered that way in Stillwater Prison. I don't know, I forget right now. I think it's Minnesota. It could be Missouri. But it's one of those M states in the Midwest. He was murdered. What happened is a lady who came to me for assistance recently for her son who's mentally ill. And please look at his case. His name is Mark Bowles, B-O-W-L-E-S. Mark Bowles' mother name is Denise Strauss. And Denise Strauss, S-P-R-O-U-S-E. She was the woman that a man in the jail called and said, please help my friend. Please help this guy who is incarcerated with me. She said, what's happening to him? And he said that every day, several times a day, the corrections officer go in his cell and take a water hose with them. They get him in there stretched out on a board, and I can't see in his cell to see what they're doing to him, but they never go in there without a water hose. He's laying out on a board, and been in that position, stretched out on a board for days, and when they go in there with that water hose, he starts screaming and begging and crying and begging them to please stop, please. And they do not stop, and they're torturing him. And so they told my friend Diana Sprouse that. And so she started making phone calls because of this torture that she knew was happening to one of the inmates in Stillwater Prison. And she called the warden. She called city or county or state officials. And finally, she called the press. And I guess they knew that this story was getting out, what they were doing to Mr. Stampley, who happened to have been a black, mentally ill man. And so they went ahead and killed him, I guess so that he would not be able to tell all the horrors he had endured. So they killed him. And you know, Dana Sprouse, because of her diligence in trying to get assistance for this man who was being tortured in that prison, she feels like that causes some of the wrongdoing that she is suffering from now with her son, Mark Bowles, B-O-W-L-E-S. But it wasn't just because she was the first person I ever heard who actually put information to my, but I had long had a theory that the mentally ill, especially black mentally ill patients, were being waterboarded in our jails and prisons. I had a theory from the time that I learned that the interrogation experts, we all heard about the interrogation experts, that's a nice name for torture experts, that they sent to Guantanamo Bay. Those people, I read the article about them, and it said that each one of them had had 80 hours of training in torture before they were sent to Guantanamo Bay. And when I first read, you know, a lot of times you read news reports and you don't really think about what they're telling you. And sometimes they, you know, they're just people. They tell you more than they intend to. Other times I think they're just being coy. They like to put the truth out there in plain English and see who will pick up on it, because they really don't care whether you and I know what they do or not. But they did say that the interrogation experts that were sent to Guantanamo Bay had already had 80 hours of training before they were sent there to try to extract information from men and women and children. I want you to know some of the people at Guantanamo Bay were only 12 years old when they arrived. So those were not all grown-ups that they were torturing. Those included children. But in any case, they had to train these people on someone. I just found out this year that some of the people they trained on were military people, and U.S. military people. Some of them were waterboarded. But I also found out that that from her account, I got confirmation of what I had suspected, that mentally ill people, blacks, were used to train torture experts for Guantanamo Bay. And so the thing is, I think that that may be what they were doing for 18 days in a jail that had already been taken over by the government. Under the USDOJ. My brother died on August 1st, 2000. Oh, that was during the period when torture was happening without us knowing about it in Guantanamo Bay. So there may be no connection, but there could be a connection. I do know that something was happening to him, the reason they won't tell us what happened. I know that they shoot black men continually, taser black men to death continually, and don't even have to be mentally ill. But the situation is that with Larry Neal, whatever they did to him is something that they don't want to talk about, and they don't want me to talk about it. They don't want you to know about it. So now that I've told you about it, maybe they'll let us go ahead and discuss these street murders, because, you know, maybe they'll say, okay, she's told it now, okay? That happened on August 1st, 2003, that he was murdered. He was secretly arrested in mid-July during a heat wave in Memphis, Tennessee. We looked for him. We had missing person reports. Police denied having him in custody until the 18th day when they admitted that they had had him the entire time, and he was dead now. How did he die? We're not telling you. One thing, let me fix this up. These other people won't turn us off. The Jenny Cochran firm divorced my family at that point. They got a wrongful death lawsuit the same day Larry died. We called the Cochran firm, and they accepted the lawsuit, and they defrauded us in favor of the jail. They signed a contract with us. They did nothing. They never filed a single lawsuit when they were supposed to file three. One against the jail, one against the state of Tennessee, of which Larry Neal was a ward, one against the care home, his final care home, because if he was having a psychological crisis, it was the care home's responsibility to get him help. So they were supposed to file three lawsuits. I'm supposed to be sitting here either with my brother alive or a millionaire. The Cochran firm got in between justice, and they worked for the jail instead of for their clients. They withheld a lawsuit while pretending to be going through with their responsibility as our lawyers. It wasn't until the end of the statute of limitations that we found out these traitors had done nothing, nothing whatsoever. We sued them twice, once in Georgia Superior Court for Judge Wendy Shube. I just want to cover all the bases so they won't be cutting me off because they're so afraid I'm going to. The way I do this is this way. They're afraid I'm going to tell you. And so I feel like if I go ahead and tell you and name all the parties, maybe they'll let us have a radio show, okay? Judge Wendy Shue ruled that the Cochran firm, they dismissed our lawsuit, lying and saying there's no Cochran firm office whatsoever in the state of Georgia. I know there were two. There's one in the Candler Building on Peachtree Street, and then they have another one for the brown people. The one on Candler is for the black people. They got another one for the brown people, the Latinos. They defraud any minorities. And then the second lawsuit was a federal lawsuit. Judge Timothy Batten was our judge in federal court, and he said whatever the Cochran firm did to prevent our lawsuit against Memphis Shelby County Jail and against the state of Tennessee was immaterial. And that's written down, that whatever they did to hold up those lawsuits is immaterial. Now, so this judge didn't even try to pick up an excuse to dismiss our lawsuit. He just said it's immaterial what these people do to you. It's immaterial that they're hiding a murder. It's immaterial that they're conspirators to a murder after the fact. It's immaterial that they are accessories to murder after the fact. It's immaterial that they lied to their clients against the rules of professional responsibility. It's immaterial because you people are. You are black and poor, and we don't answer to you, we being rich white elitists. So I wanted you to know that. If I didn't tell you enough, if they cut me off again, I'll tell you some more. They don't want me to talk about the street people that got killed in Arizona. They didn't want me to tell you about the man who was burned alive in California by one of his neighbors. So I'll go ahead and tell you every time from now on about my brother's secret covered-up murder that's ongoing, and I'll name names every time I tell you, and then maybe they'll learn to stop hanging up the damn phone on me. Let me go to someone else. Bob, go ahead.
Yeah, we were cut off earlier, and I had to call back again. I don't know what
was going
on. Well,
you know, maybe they'll stop now because they're so worried every time I go on air, oh, she's going to tell about our covered-up secret murder. This is a national secret, and she's going to tell it. So from now on, maybe I need to just tell that the first 10 minutes so we can go ahead and have a real radio show without all of these cutoffs and interruptions. What do you think about that idea?
Well, I think it's a good idea. I mean, you are very good at naming names and making lists of the terrible things that are going on, and I'm just enthralled or just cemented to the phone, listening to what you're talking about. I'm wondering if anybody has called in to talk. Do we have any call-ins?
Matter of fact, I believe that we have Miss Lillian Eaglefeather on the air. Her show starts at exactly 4 o'clock our time. That's in 6 minutes. And then you and I are going to turn it over to Ms. Eaglefeather. Ms. Eaglefeather, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty good. How are the both of you?
Fine, thank
you. Great. I wanted to finish telling you about this man that this guy burned up in California. This guy used to sit there on the corner, and the guy came by. He threw flammable liquid on him. It turned out later it was gasoline, and then he threw a match, and he burnt the man alive. He just burnt him to death right there in front of everybody's face. And people were trying to put him out, but that wouldn't work. And this man he burned up was a harmless and gentle guy. But, of course, he didn't live with the sisters for whatever reason. He lived right there in that alley. He had made friends. You know, they had a memorial. The neighborhood thought so much of this homeless man that they had a big memorial service for him. And they were looking for his killer on America's Most Wanted. And it was through America's Most Wanted that his killer was found. And it turned out to be a neighbor. It turned out to be a very upstanding type neighbor. And I will get you more information about that. But I just want to illustrate to you how cruel some of the regular people in the community can be to homeless people. There are bullies everywhere, and not all of them are in police departments, but unfortunately a great many of them are in police departments. So I just wanted to let you know about that murder, and I was telling you about it in preparation for Ms. Lynn Eaglefeather, who is going to tell us about the murders that happened in New Mexico this weekend while we pursued our daily lives. And the thing is that Ms. Eaglefeather is a woman who has actually been homeless, long-term homeless, before in her life. And she could tell you about some of the dangers that she was trying to avoid. Another night, I used to work downtown in Atlanta. That's where Bob Darby and I live, in Atlanta area. And sometimes I would go to this particular Waffle House because they're open all night long. And when I would get lunch, I would usually stay in the building because it was so late when I ate lunch. I ate lunch at like 2:30 in the morning. But now and then I would go to this Waffle House for lunch because Waffle Houses, you know, are open 24 hours a day. And I went there one night, and as I came out, a lady came rushing up to me, and obviously she was a homeless lady. And she said, Miss, could you help me, please? She said, what's the matter? Her hair was all in disarray, beyond regular. And she said, I was just raped. And so I said, oh, my goodness. I said, well, you know, there are police in here in the Waffle House. Come on, let's go and report it to them. And I started walking back toward the door, and she ran away from me. She was like, oh, no, don't call the police. Oh, no, not the police, not the police. And you got to understand that not only are these homeless people often accosted, but they are afraid to make a report to the police. They are afraid of the police. So when she told me she was just raped, her dress was torn, she only was wearing one shoe, and her hair was in disarray, and she told me that she had just gotten raped, I started walking back toward the door so that she could make a report to the police who were in there eating, and another one was guarding the place. And she ran away from me. So that is a big problem. That is another big part of what's going on with the mentally ill when they are victims of crimes. They are afraid to make a report. Bob Darby, what do you think about that?
I think that what you're saying is absolutely true. And one thing about making a report is that it used to be that there were payphones within easy reach of just about everywhere, and they've taken payphones out so that somebody does need to make a distressed call to 911. How are they going to do it if they don't have a cell phone? And most, you know, it's a rare homeless person who has a cell phone. So if a person has been raped, has been assaulted, is being stalked by criminals, and they go up to an individual who is not homeless, apparently, and says, may I use your cell phone? I've just been raped. Most people would not let them use a cell phone if they had one. So if someone goes into is homeless and goes into a Waffle House and tries to get assistance from them, they're afraid to call the police because the police will find out they're homeless and arrest them and will not allow them to. I mean, I have no doubt that what you're saying is true. So as I was saying earlier, and I'll repeat myself, homeless people have almost no rights, not only as citizens, they have no rights as human beings because they're no rights as human beings whatsoever. So it used to be back in centuries past that if a person was out of favor with the powers that be, with the nobles who ran the land in the Middle Ages, or the royals who didn't want to bother with putting somebody in jail or executing them, they would do something that was called outlawing, which means that they would deprive that person of any individual civil rights whatsoever, so that people could commit crimes against them and they would have no protection of the law. So if a person was declared to be outlawed by the powers that be in previous times, that would mean that they would have no protection from the law. Well, so what has happened is that being homeless and being mentally ill has been, in effect, turning these people into outlaws. They're made so that anyone can commit crimes against them, and they have no redress from the government or from the law enforcement people. So, I have no doubt that this happens. It used to happen. It used to be an official process whereby a judge or a royal person or a noble would say, we don't like this guy. He no longer has the right to police protection. Anybody could do anything they wanted to this individual, and there will be no charges brought against them. So that procedure of outlawing people has been reenacted, in effect, against the homeless, against the mentally ill, against, you know, really anyone who can't afford to throw money at lawyers or at judges or bribe people or whatever it takes to get civil rights confirmed. In this country, it takes money. Now, I feel the same way you do about money. Money is a wonderful thing. It's the way that we produce, that we are exchange goods and services. It's the love of money, like you said, that is wicked, that is evil. And that is what is being encouraged in this society, so that money, the possession of money, is the be-all and end-all in this society. And how much money you have determines how many rights you have as a citizen. And that's wrong. So, no, I don't object to modest wealth. But personally, you may disagree with me on this, Mary. I don't know. Personally, I don't believe that anyone can come by $1 billion, that's $1,000 million, by honest, decent work. I think that the possession of $1,000 million in itself makes me very suspicious that the person who has $1 billion is not an upright person, because that is basically an unlimited amount of money, and people do not acquire unlimited amounts of money by honest, decent work. I'm sorry. It's not that I hate money. It's not that I hate wealthy people. I don't object to a modest amount of wealth. But as long as there are millions of people living on the streets in the United States, just take the United States. As long as there are millions of people living on the streets of the United States because of a lack of money, because of the most destituted poverty possible, as long as there are millions of people in jail and prison, largely because they couldn't afford decent legal representation, billionaires look obscene to me, frankly. I mean, I'm sorry, I'll admit to some hostility against a situation in which fewer than 200 billionaires control more than half of all of the wealth of this country. 200 people. So, no, I don't say that all wealthy people are bad, but I say that personally, I cannot believe that anyone who has wealth as great as $1,000 million, which is what a billion is, I cannot believe that anyone can acquire that much money by honest work. I don't believe it.
Well,
so,
Bob, I tell you, you know, I think that we have some examples. Oprah Winfrey, she was paid an extreme amount of money, and she probably invested wisely, and I think that she has been a billionaire for a few years now. And then we can have some movie stars. I mean, they're paid exorbitant amounts of money, people in entertainment who are the top stars. And over a period of time, it can add up to be billions because they're getting paid millions for each movie.
They're being paid extravagant amounts of money for hugely extravagant amounts of money in order to bring them into the criminal class that's not recognized. We disagree on this. I mean, I do not.
Okay.
I'm not casting aspersions. I'm not saying nasty things about.
Could I interrupt you just a second?
Sure.
I want you to continue, and I want Ms. Lynn Eaglefeather to come right on in. Everyone, this is Lynn Eaglefeather. She's of the Lakota people. Is that right, Lynn?
Yes, I am.
Yes, she's of the Lakota people. She has experienced a lot of the things that Native Americans have gone through in this country, and she will tell you about that. In fact, she already has on previous shows, and I ask you to go back and listen to our previous shows, Bob Darby, Human Rights Demand, and listen to Ms. Eaglefeather because she has the second hour of the Bob Darby Human Rights Demand show, and we're going to come up with a new name for the show because both of these are great human rights advocates, and they share Thursdays. And I would like for the both of you to continue to discuss whatever you wish. I'm going to be within earshot of the phone, but I'm not going to be on the phone for a few minutes. Is that okay with you, Lynn?
Yes, it is.
How long are we
okay
going to be on? It's okay with me, but we've already been on the air
for an hour. Lynn is going to be on the next hour. I was aware that you have your respiratory problems, and when I took it to two-hour shows, everybody, Human Rights Demand, Monday through Friday, is on 2 hours now. And so since I knew you wouldn't want the second hour, Ms. Lynn Eaglefeather's show starts at 4 p.m., so I want to give her a chance to come on air. It's her second hour begun right now. But I'm sure she doesn't mind if you complete your thought regarding what you feel like about the filthy lucre.
That's right. That's the way I feel about it. I mean, that's the way I feel about it. It's filthy lucre. And, I mean, Oprah Winfrey and even Bill Gates, they seem like really nice people when you see them on television. And, you know, but I'm sorry, I don't believe that anybody can accumulate $1,000,000,000 and have clean hands. I just can't believe it. I mean, I'm a few million dollars, okay, all right. You know, I think that people should be well paid for extraordinary achievements. I have nothing against that. But $1 billion? I mean, that's just how can anybody pile up that much money by honest effort? The system is set up so that the more money you have, the more extravagant wealth you have, if you pump more and more of your money back into that system, into various investment vehicles, as they call them, that money is going to go to things like you call, as you point out, the prison industry. So I would bet that a lot of the investments, the Gates have investments in the prison industry. And I would imagine that Oprah Winfrey and a lot of other people who are billionaires, they don't even know where their money is invested. Because it's like when Mitt Romney was running for president, he reportedly had a fortune in excess of $250 million. And he couldn't even name the places where his money was invested because he had turned his portfolio over to professional investors who were simply investing in what brought about the greatest yield and which were available only to the super wealthy to begin with. So when people become a part of that social class, that extremely elite, very, very tiny percentage of people who are 100 millionaires and billionaires, they don't even know where their money is going. They just know that they are beyond normal human reckoning and beyond normal human judgment. So, yes, I'll admit to being suspicious. I won't call it prejudice. I am suspicious of anyone who has great wealth. And in this society, I am. I'll admit to it. And I don't know how Ms. Eaglefeather feels about this or anyone else who happens to be listening to it. I am not a part of any kind of political movement. I do not call myself, for example, a communist. I will say that I'm on the left because being on the left means I support the rights of people whose rights are being taken away. I support the right of people to live. I support the right of people to be protected by the law, to not be made outlaws. I support the right of everyone to have food to eat, of a place to live, of medical care, and of education. And in some countries, all of those are guaranteed as rights to citizenship. And I can name some of those countries. Denmark, which I visited, Sweden, Norway, the Netherlands, Belgium. In these countries, homelessness has been supposedly eliminated. I don't know that it truly has. But if you live in any of these countries, it's a right of citizenship. You're guaranteed a roof over your head. You're guaranteed protection of the laws. You're guaranteed nutrition. You're guaranteed medical care when you need it. You're guaranteed education, and you're guaranteed access to employment. I'm almost 70 years old, and when I was a young man, the term, the expression, homeless mentally ill was unheard of. And if people had talked about the mentally ill or the sick people of any type being abandoned to the streets, it wouldn't have been believable in the late 60s or the 70s that we would actually develop into a society such as we have right now, in which people are denied everything when they are thrown out on the street. They're put into absolute poverty. Millions of people are put into absolute poverty, while a handful of a few hundred people at the most control over half of the entire economy. Yes, I'll admit, I have a hostility towards billionaires. I do, because I do not believe anyone can honestly come by them. They're not out holding people up. What they do is they turn their fortunes over to professional investors whose job it is to invest these vast fortunes into investment vehicles that will make their fortunes even greater, that grow exponentially all the time. So Mitt Romney doesn't know how he came by his $250 million because he turned his money over to professional investors. Bill Gates, one of the smartest people, undoubtedly one of the most intelligent people in the country, William Buffett, all of these people, the people who own the Waltons, who own Walmart, they don't know, they couldn't even tell you where their money is invested because their money is invested in those vehicles that yield the highest return. And those vehicles that yield the highest return are like the armaments industry, the prison industry, industries that are there simply to generate money without regard to human rights, without regard to human welfare. So,
that even goes down to the normal working person. When you think about investing your money in things that you don't want to support, it also goes down to regular people with 401k plans. You got a regular little job. You may make between $30,000 and $75,000 a year, and to you, you're barely making it. And you have a 401k plan, and they're investing your retirement account into prisons. Many of mothers who go to prison and hug their babies, and they're crying, and they're upset, and they're writing, but help me, help me, help me. Those mothers are prison investors, and they don't even know it because they have retirement accounts through their job, and their retirement account may be investing their 401k plan with prisons or with the war industry. So it is possible, radio listening audience, that you could be a prison investor. And I ask that if that bothers you, that you would please call your personnel administrator and ask them about the companies that are listed on your 401k plan and make sure you're not a prison investor.
Bob, well, what about just having a checking account? What about just having a checking account? If you're putting money in a bank, they're investing that money. And so anyone who even has...
But that's different. These people are making direct investments strictly from the prison system. They, the bank invests your money. And true, you should try to find out if the bank is a prison investor. But your 401k plan is your individual retirement account plan. And that money, the dividends off of that comes to you. And if you're investing in prisons, there is something you can do about it. You can get a different way to save for your retirement. You could tell your company that you are not going to stay with that 401k plan. You can tell them to invest in one of the other companies that is, you know, on that same plan. There is something you could do about that. Bob, it's Lynn Eagle-Feather time. Can I bring her on now?
Yeah, I think so. That's what I was going to say. Let's hear what Lynn. Do you mind if I call you Lynn?
Yes.
Call me. That's fine. Call me Bob, Lynn. Call me Bob.
Okay,
you know what
Bob.
I mean?
And listen, Bob and Lynn, another caller has been trying to call in, and they tried three times, and I think that they're blocking our calls from the public. I asked more of you to try to call in just to see whether or not anything happens. Go.
Hello?
I'm here. Lynn?
Oh, yes. My name is Lynn Eaglefeather. Do you think we're on the air, Bob?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Do you think we're... Yes.
Can you... Okay, good. Then we must be on the air then.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll just keep going. I don't know what happened to Mary. You think we should hang up and try to call back, or...?
No, I think that Mary delivered me.
Lynn, when I drop out, please continue. Please continue.
Okay.
They don't want me on their own radio show. Understand that. So when I drop out, that means nothing. Please continue.
Okay. My name is Lynn Eaglefeather. I'm from the Sichangu Lakota Nation from Rosebud, South Dakota. I have been homeless. I was homeless for 3.5 years out on the streets, but I consider myself homeless all my life, being raised in foster homes. But I would like to open my show with a prayer because I pray every day, and I would like to pray right now real quick. Thank you for this day. Thank you for my sobriety, my home, my family. Thank you for life. Thank you for everything, the food, my home, everything that you've given to me, Tunkashala, is because of you. I pray for all the people out there that are suffering, the people that are on the streets, the people that are sick in the hospitals, behind bars, in institutions. I pray for the ones in the hospices. I pray for the military, the firefighters. I pray for everybody, Tunkashala, that you may keep them safe and out of harm's way. And I pray for the children over there in Israel that are being murdered and killed for no reason. That is so sad. And the people and the children down in the border that are caged like dogs. I saw pictures of that on the internet, and it was so sad, Tunkashala. Please help these children. What's going to happen to them? And I just want to thank you and pray for the earth, the sun, the moon, the stars, everything, the water, you know, that it may be good for our children, our grandchildren, our children, great-grandchildren to come, Tunkashala. Thank you for everything. Okay, first of all, I want to read. We have seven virtues of our Lakota people. And this one is, I read one every week. And this one goes to our children. And it says, As an eagle prepares its young to leave the nest, with all the skills and knowledge it needs to participate in life, in the same manner, so will I guide my own children. I will use the culture to prepare them for life. The most important thing I can give my children is my time. I will spend time with them in order to learn from them and to listen to them. I will teach my children to pray, as well as the importance of respect. We are the caretakers of our children. For the Creator, they are His children, not ours. I am proud of my native language. I will learn it if I can and help my children to learn it. In today's world, it is easy for the children to go astray. Can you hear me, Bob?
Hello? I'm sorry, I didn't know it would interrupt you.
Hello?
I was trying to call a guest to attract all our shows several times. Hello, this is Mary Neal at Human Rights Demand. Had you tried to call the show?
Yes, I did. I had some suggestions for people getting help who want to get...
Let me ask you, please, did you have trouble staying on the line?
No. No. I got cut off once.
Okay. I just noticed that you were cut off, and so I wanted to call back and apologize to you and let you know that we have quite a bit of that, and I didn't know whether they had cut you off all the times. I think they cut you off three times, or you cut off three times, and I just was concerned, and I thought I would call you. Right now we're listening to Ms. Lynn Eaglefeather, and she is talking to us about circumstances having to do with homelessness, and then we will let you speak, too, and tell what you think about what we've been discussing today. Is that all right?
That'd be good.
All right, but so now you're on the air. Don't hang up, and I'll know if they cut you off that it was them and not you. So go ahead, Ms. Eaglefeather. I'm sorry for the interruption.
Okay, I was reading one of the seven virtues of our Lakota people. Somebody's breathing real hard into the phone, and I can't hardly hear. Okay, thank you. Okay, it says, I am proud of my native language. I will learn it if I can and help my children to learn it. In today's world, it is easy for the children to go astray. I will work to provide positive alternatives for them. I will teach them the culture. I will encourage education, sports, and talk to the elders for guidance. But mostly, I will seek to be a role model myself. I make this commitment to my children so they will have courage and find guidance through our traditional ways. And my topic today is on the homelessness. I was homeless for 3.5 years. I slept out on the streets. I had a boyfriend at the time that we would have to find spots to go sleep. We would have to find a safe spot. I would sleep up against the wall, and he would sleep on the other side of me, and that was the protection, was the wall and the trees, so no one could see us. And I was attacked before. A guy followed me I was going to my friends, and I was attacked. And he grabbed my purse, and I had my cell phone on me. But it was either the purse or cell phone. We were fighting, struggling against. He was pulling these things from me, and so I let go of the purse. I had my money, ID, everything in there. I let go of the purse and held on to the phone, and I called the police right away. The police came. I had to go to the hospital to get checked out because I had scrapes. And the good thing, my friends heard me screaming. They came running down the alley and saw me laying on the ground and picked me up, and ambulance came for me and took me to the hospital. But like they were saying in the last show, Bob and Mary, I was reluctant to stay in the hospital. And I did file this report, but I didn't know this gentleman. I didn't, well, he's not a gentleman. I didn't know this person. And I didn't know the name. I'd never seen him before. And he just followed me and attacked me. So they drove me around in the police car trying to look for him, but I couldn't find him. They took me to the hospital, and I was reluctant to stay and get checked out because I had a warrant. So therefore, I left the hospital. And that's what we were talking about earlier, about people not reporting these crimes because maybe they do have a warrant. Maybe, you know, the police will not listen. And the police don't care. You know, people don't care about homeless people. It's sad. But my topic today is about the homeless. There's three homeless guys that got attacked in Albuquerque, New Mexico. They were sleeping in a vacant lot. And they were asleep. One of them, the survivor, lone survivor, is a nephew to one of the ones that got murdered. Okay, there was a 15-year-old Gilbert Tafoya, 16-year-old Nathaniel Carrillo, 18-year-old Alex Rios, and there were rumors about Gilbert getting violent, thought it was just with other kids. He didn't know that it was with the homeless people. And three teens admitted to attacking more than 50 homeless people all over Albuquerque in the past few months. And finally, bludgeoning two homeless men a hundred feet away from Gilbert Tafoya's house. And some Albuquerque police department said the crime scene made them sick to their stomachs. Gilbert was homeless too at one time, his father said, and he said it was hard for him to believe that his son did this because of the fact that they were homeless too before. Tafoya had just got off probation for marijuana charges, and he was charged with two counts of murder and conspiracy. Police are trying to figure out if any recent unsolved crimes were committed by these teens. And that was dated 7/21, and this is dated 7/22. I looked this up. And a homeless outreach advocate in Albuquerque says the men were beat to death while they slept in a vacant lot, not the first time that the homeless people had been targeted. Father Rusty Smith of St. Martin's Hospitality Center in Albuquerque expressed his frustration and despair after meeting with the mayor of Albuquerque. And he said that often our clients are afraid to call police because they're afraid they'll get in trouble, just like I. And that's why so much of the crime that happens and the crime that happens to goes uninvestigated, just like me. Albuquerque Chief of Police said there is a fear of homeless and police trying to fix relationships. The Albuquerque Police Department is sending plainclothes police officers out into the field, out to talk to these homeless people to try and find out if they have been attacked in the past few months by these teens. There were actually five of them, but these three are the ones that got caught. And where were the parents, you know? Where was the parenting as the teens roamed the streets at night terrorizing the homeless? Where were the father? Where was the mother at? You know, that's my question. There were warning signs with the three teens. 15-year-old Gilbert Tafoya, 18-year-old Nathaniel and 16-year-old Nathaniel and 18-year-old Alex. I even told the police that they were terrorizing homeless people for months. Oh, one even told them. One admitted he told on the rest of them. But all may be enough, not be enough to hold the parents accountable. That means that the parents are not going to be held accountable. So for the families of Tapoya and Carrillo, because they're underage, watch as the teens. They faced the judge Monday and charges that they bludgeoned the two homeless men to death in a vacant lot. My question would be, who failed these kids? How'd they get to this point? Officer Simon Drobic, spokesman for the APD. One teen has a criminal history for burglary and arson that he committed when he was 12 years old. All had dropped out of school. 15-year-old Tafoya admitted to beating up the homeless people, and there are no law to hold the parents accountable. Now, if they were if they had mental disabilities, then they could be charged. The parents could be charged. Longtime district attorney stressed need for more services for homeless people in Albuquerque. All their bonds are set at $5 million, and that's the highest that's been set for the city of Albuquerque. I know I used to live in Albuquerque. I went to school at an Indian college there, and it's not a very big city. It's all spread out. And if tried as adults, they could spend the rest of their lives behind bars. And what a waste of time for these young killers. In 2014, a 15-year-old boy's mother was charged with child abuse, resulting in death after her son charged with murdering a friend. She was charged with letting her son run wild when she knew he had mental problems and was violent. He's accused of bludgeoning his 12-year-old friend to death in a field. And the mom's name is Loretta Villalobos, and her son's name is Brandon. Now, I did some more research today on the Albuquerque police, and they're struggling to identify them because they were beat so bad. They were beat with bricks, sticks, and metal fence pole. The 15-year-old said that they took turns picking up cinder blocks over their heads and smashing their faces. Acts of violence lasted, the whole act of violence lasted 20 minutes to an hour. They were beat. And the lone survivor said that he tried to fight them off, but they kept hitting his uncle. They kept beating him with that pole, and he was trying to fight them off, but there was five of them, but the two of them got away. And they said that the crimes are getting younger and younger. I mean, the crime committed by the young people, they're getting younger and younger, and expressed parenting failures. You know, what's going on with the parenting, what's going on in their homes so that these children have to commit a crime at such a young age, 12 years old, getting caught for murder, 13. It's really a sad situation. And 85% of the crimes committed are under 30, and that was in 2013. Now, Michael Stoops, he's the director of community organizing at the National Coalition for the Homeless. He said that most of them tend to be white men who are bored to death. That's what his quote. Homeless people are amongst the most vulnerable to be victims of violent crimes, as more than any other group in society. One state senator said it was a hate crime, something that would land offenders in prison for a longer time. One teen said they had been targeting and attacking homeless people for a year. 1 year. And it went all, most of them went all unreported. The DA said it wasn't a hate crime according to how law was written. But Senator Bill O'Neill said these individuals are target, quote, these individuals are targeted the way folks of different sexual orientation are, unquote. O'Neill plans to introduce a bill in legislative session, change that, and add the homeless as a protected group under existing hate crimes law. Some states already include homeless as a protected class under hate crime legislation. He tried to do something in 2013, but it was unsuccessful. The fact, quote, the fact these individuals are homeless, it fits the category of vulnerable individuals in out there in society that are targeted because of their vulnerability. Unquote. Senator Mark Morse voted against the bill, saying it was a hate crime. It wouldn't have stopped these kids from doing that night. We need to look at why they were out there, why they weren't in school to start with, what else the system failed to protect them, the killers, and these poor victims, unquote. And they're already planning on reintroducing the bill. And he was moved to add homeless individuals to hate crimes law because he witnessed of what he witnessed while volunteering at homeless shelters downtown. Now, I remember I was talking to a friend of mine, and about 20 years ago, there was a lot of hate crimes here in Denver. In Denver, when they were building the Coors Field and where the Rockies played, it was this white supremacist groups, and they were targeting the homeless people while they were sleeping also and decapitating them. And my friend told me that her friend's mother got decapitated, and they never found her head. They could never, and they held her body for a whole year until they finally released her body to her daughter so she could cremate it. But, you know, it's just an awful thing that these people are doing, you know, to the homeless. And it's there's a lot of homeless. I just feel so bad for these young children that have to live in motels, that have to live in shelters, that have to leave every morning. At 5 o'clock, at 6 o'clock, they have to get out of the shelter, go for the day, unless it's really hot, and then they let them stay in there. But the majority of the shelters are full all the time, because there's quite a few shelters here in Denver. But they do have programs. The Coalition for the Homeless, Colorado Coalition for the Homeless, is a wonderful program, and that's how I got housed. I admitted I was an alcoholic, and I am clean and sober now. I admitted I was an alcoholic and that I needed help to get off the streets. I went through a two-year program of going to groups, of going to seek counseling, and to stay sober and clean in order to maintain my housing. I have now been housed to the Coalition for 6 years, and I have now been in my same apartment for 5 years, and that is the longest I have ever lived anywhere in my whole life, because I was raised in abusive foster homes, and we moved about every year, every other year. You know, I mean, we never knew where we were going, what kind of people we were going to, and what type of abuse we were going to be subjected to. So my homelessness, I would say, they asked me to fill out a paper and explain my homelessness. And I told them that I was homeless my whole life. I remember one house, and with my biological parents, and that's it. All the rest of it was moving around my whole life. But I've been on my own since I was 15. I got my GED. I went to a junior college in Albuquerque, Southwestern Indian Polytech Institute. I took drafting. I wanted to be an architect. and was in an abusive relationship, and so had to be flown back from Albuquerque to Denver. I was all beat up, so I couldn't go back to school there. But I went on to move back to Lincoln, Nebraska, where I was raised, and I went to college. I went to University of Nebraska at the age of 18, but I was pregnant at the
time. So now you did all of that coming from your situation that you were in. You did all of that. You accomplished so much. I want to give 9836 a moment to go ahead and make his comment. We have another 20 minutes, so we'll come back to you, please, Ms. Lynn. But I want to give our caller the courtesy of letting him speak. Is that all right?
Sure.
Okay.
I want to hear what he has.
Caller, go right ahead.
Yes. Well, we don't have, in Atlanta, we don't have individuals, hate groups, or criminals attacking the homeless, but what we do have is governments cutting funding for homeless shelters, and they just closed 250-bed shelters. Most of our shelters are 20 or 30 beds, but we have a few 150-bed shelters. And they were closed because the government of the county, Fulton County, closed or cut the budget by $1.8 million. That county spends more on the arts than it does on homeless shelters. And these shelters were for men and women with children. They were for drug and alcohol dependent people and people who needed vocational counseling. So it was more than just going into a shelter and sleeping. You got services during the day, and that helped you get a job or helped you get clean. It seems like it's a real pro-family thing to do for people, you know, to help them get back on their feet. But we're trying to open up the shelters again. We've got some people working on the issue, and we're sending out email, and we're on the radio on Radio Free Georgia. It's a community radio station, 89.3 FM, and we're discussing what we can do to help the people have some shelters. And we really don't have a lot of shelters. One of the biggest shelters, which is an overflow shelter, is under attack by the city, and they're trying to sell the property so that the university, Emory University, can buy the property. It's across the street from a hospital owned by the university. And that's a big issue, and they've got emails that prove that some of the powers that be were trying to dry up the funds and the grants for the shelter. So we have three shelters that are at risk, and two have already been closed. And we want people around the country to know that this is a national problem. This isn't just in New York or Los Angeles. This is all over the country. And we have to build coalitions and fight for our rights. And USA Today newspaper reported that 15% of the homeless people are veterans. So not only is it affecting mentally ill people and drug and alcohol users and economic people with problems, but it's affecting soldiers that are coming back from the expensive wars in Iraq and elsewhere. And we also had a homeless encampment that was torn down by a bulldozer by the Georgia Department of Transportation in January. This was on the coldest day of the year, and 16 tents were buried. Let me tell you, these tents are not cheap. You know, if you've ever had to buy a tent for somebody, they're over $100, and these homeless people are losing their property, and they're being abused in cold weather. And this is the Georgia Department of Transportation that did this. So we're on the radio on Radio Free Georgia, 89.3 FM. It's a 100,000-watt non-commercial station that's it's not NPR, it's not college radio, but it's on the same band as the Lakota station in Pine Ridge that the Lakota people listen to, Keeley Radio. But we really need it's related to that station.
Okay.
So
I'll listen.
We hear your testimony, and if we can do anything to write letters to Albuquerque, or if we can talk about it on our radio station and get conventions to stop going there because it's so bad for homeless people, we'll try to do that. And we'll tune in next week and try to contribute to the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I pray for all the people over there in Georgia and in those shelters that are being shut down. You know, they're building shelters for cats and dogs, brand new shelters, and it's just inhumane. Our people should come first before any animal, you know. And,
I know it's hard to sit with it and live with it. We got to get organized. And one thing I recommend, I think if we can make 500 leaflets and go out to areas that are not near the homeless area, but make leaflets for areas that are confused about the issue, because there's a lot of misinformation about this issue. And if we can educate people in other areas and get them on our side, maybe that will help, because this issue is related to other issues. It's related to the military-industrial complex. It's related to all the prisoners that are in jail. It's related to the police violence, or the police shooting people, innocent people. It's related to these low wages that so many people earn in this country. And I think these are symptomatic of a sick system that needs... It needs medicine. It needs a prescription. And we are divided by geography and history, but we're united in the fact that we're all American people. And we can fight together and form alliances across state borders. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for that. You are so right. We are all human, first of all. We are all human. We all bleed the same, and we all live and die, you know.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I will listen. I will tune into your radio station. I will listen to it, 89.3. I wrote it down.
It's look up Radio Free Georgia.
Okay.
Radio Free Georgia, Atlanta. That look that up on the internet.
Okay, I will. I was going to tell you that we have right here in Colorado, they opened, it was an old prison, and they fixed it up into a treatment facility. And the people that go through the Coalition for the Homeless, they have several different programs. The PASS program, which is for the mentally ill. The STS, which I went through, was for the treatment, substance treatment services. And the Native American Talking Circle, which I attend off and on, but that's how I got my housing. And they're sending the people to these treatment facilities and for a 90-day program. And after they finish the program, and then they're given housing. So, and they also have the YMCA here that they opened up for the Coalition for the Homeless. They're building buildings all over. Nancy Pelosi came to the Coalition for the Homeless and toured it a few years back. And after that, they got a lot of funding. So I don't know why Georgia can't get the funding like Colorado did, because they're building new buildings all over for the homeless people. And in the wintertime, they have outreach workers who go out and they'll hand out gloves, hats, socks, dry socks, you know, hygiene packets, or they'll go in there and they'll take these people off the streets and they'll put them in a shelter or a motel, give them a motel voucher, especially if it's extremely cold. Because one time a homeless guy, he fell asleep. I mean, he slept downtown right by the state capitol. He froze to death. All these lawyers and public defenders and all these people were going to the courthouse to go, you know, to court. And here was this man laying there dead, froze to death, and people thought he was just sleeping. And they were walking right past him. Another guy died on the mall the same way.
It sounds like Colorado is doing some good things, except for this case of the guy who froze to death. We're getting local and national money. I'm not an expert about where the money is coming from, but I've looked into it, and we're getting HUD money, Housing and Urban Development money. They have something called Continuum of Care. And we also get local county money. We have homeless shelters in other cities in Georgia, not just in Atlanta. There are several other places that have shelters. There's one in Vidalia where Mexican farm workers pick onions and tomatoes. And there's a shelter in, I think, Rome or Dalton in the North Georgia area. The wages need to go up, for one thing. The minimum wage is not enough to live outside of the poverty level on. Too many people are working at a poverty level. And I'm not making that up. That's the official statistic. If you work full-time on $7.25, you're still in poverty. And that's unacceptable. And also, the state mental hospitals and clinics are being cut back. We don't know what's going to happen a year from now, but we do know that they're trying to change the system from state mental hospitals to clinics, and we're not sure if people are going to know where to go to get help, or if they're really sick, if they'll be able to get help. We don't know if that will work. So this is a debate in the mental health movement, and for more information, you can look up N like Nancy, A like Apple, M like Maryland, I like Italy.org, NAMI.org. They investigate state mental hospitals and try to make sure they're doing the right thing and that they're treating people the right way. And it's a national organization for mentally ill, brain disordered people. But I love talking to somebody who's gone to college out there and who knows about Lakota people. I know about Leonard Peltier. I've read his book. Leonard Peltier's book. I've written him.
The Political Prisoner.
I've written him.
Wrote
he wrote me back. Yeah, I've written him.
Oh, my. Wow, that's great. That's great. Yeah,
I'm concerned about Shelby County. I think Memphis is a little closer to Atlanta than Colorado. And I think that if people are dying in the jail in Shelby County, we need to do something about that. And there's a good radio station in
You're ringing my bell. My brother was secretly arrested. He was not an inmate. He was a frequent flyer through that jail. They would only keep him usually a few hours, so maybe overnight, and they would get in touch with his family or social worker to come and get him because he was an acute mental patient suffering from schizophrenia and also suffering from a serious heart condition. So he had two disabilities. One was his physical health and one was his mind. And they would always get him out of there as quick as he came. But on one particular occasion, that was his fatal arrest, They kept him secretly 18 days, hid him there, lied to his family, lied to a social worker, ignored the missing person reports, denied having him when we called for help. We needed help looking for him. They did not help look for him because they knew where he was. And on the 18th day, they murdered him by some method, and we have not gotten any information on that yet. They refused an inquest. They refused to do an investigation. They refused to even tell us why Larry Neal was arrested. So you can look that up. There's a website. It's called Wrongful Death of Larry Neal. He was not homeless. He lived in a care home. He was a ward of the state of Tennessee because he did something that showed how sick he was and how much he needed to be in the hospital, and instead of them putting him in the hospital, they accepted him in a care home. And so he had lived as a ward of the state of Tennessee for some years, but they really dropped the ball on this one, and they did not adequately search for him. His picture was never displayed on the media, and the police had him all while, and I guess everybody was in agreement to kill him this time. And so he was murdered. And we're his family, and they will not tell us anything about their murder. And the USDOJ is included in the conspirators regarding that whole cover-up. So, yes, you have my phone number. I'm here at Human Rights Demand every day at 3 p.m., and my home number is 678-531-0262. I'm greatly censored to keep people from knowing that this thing goes beyond simply waiting until somebody make a lunacy call on someone who's sick and the police kill them. These people are actually arresting people secretly and killing them in jail and then giving their family members nothing but grief when they ask what happened to Larry Neal. And so this is a... I don't feel like he was the first one that was secretly arrested and killed, and I don't feel like he was the last one. This is something that we need to all be very concerned about, because if it happened to one of our mentally ill people, it's probably happened to others. At the time when he was murdered like that, we didn't know about organ theft. We didn't know about people being used for scientific experiments. We didn't know any of these horrible things. But now that we do know, my 91-year-old mother would certainly like to know what happened to her son, Larry Neal. So the website is called Wrongful Death of Larry Neal. And that happened right there in Memphis, Tennessee jail. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that.
Thank you, Mary. I read the blog. I read it. And I would like to also give my phone number. It's 720-629-5309, and maybe I have I'll have more suggestions and some another topic for next week. But thank you for having me on the air, and thank you. What was your name that called in?
My name is Paul Hayes.
Paul Hayes, thank you very much. You can call me on my number, and maybe we can get some suggestions together as far as protests or something. We need to do something for these people.
Is that 720 or is that 720?
Yes.
Okay.
629. Yes. 629-5309. And I'm in Denver, Colorado. Thank you so much. Maybe we could you can give me a call and we could talk about Leonard.
Okay, I'll do that. We have a support group that meets in Atlanta. Thank you.
Oh, wow.
Well,
okay,
thank you so much, Paul. It was wonderful to have you on the show. And, Lynn, it's always an educational experience for the radio audience when you come on the line. And, Bob Darby, if you're listening, awesome show today. Thank you so much. I mean, you were red hot today. You really gave us a lot to think about regarding people who are, as you say, filthy rich. While other people are starving to death and their consciousness let them do that, just pile up more money than they could spend in 20 lifetimes while other people are without bread. And, of course, they're without water in Detroit. So that's something we're going to talk about on Saturday. If you have an interest in the water war in Detroit and also in the trial that's going on now in Detroit, Mr. Wafer, who killed a 19-year-old black woman whose car stopped and she went to his house, Ms. McBride. If you're interested in the Wafer McBride trial and the water war in Detroit, I ask you to tune in on Saturday when we will talk about Release the Innocent. Ms. McBride was murdered, and he's on trial now, and there's a water war going on. I think that's a recipe for possible disaster for the whole country, and it needs to be addressed. God bless you all. Thank you for joining us today on Human Rights Demand. Say goodbye, please, Ms. Lynn. Say goodbye, please, Ms. Paul.
I'll talk to you next week, and you all have a good week, and be safe out there, and especially if you're homeless, be safe.
God bless you all, and God bless America with justice for all. Good day, everybody.
Good day.